Progressive Radio News Hour with Stephen Ledman, Thursdays at 11 a.m. and weekends at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Ledman. We have two guests today on the first half of the program. Regular listeners know Marty Nazemroya. He's back. He's home safe now. He's back in Canada. He's traveling. He's not in his home city, but he's close by. And we want to talk to Marty. And the second half of the program, Bruce Gagnon will be on. Bruce has done marvelous work, and we'll get into some of what he's doing now and other thoughts that concerning him. Let me just say a few comments before we begin. Today is certainly an important day, and it's a day that I got ready for a number of days ago. This morning I wrote my fifth article relating to 9/11, and I began with an article that I called Media Manipulation of 9/11 Truth. And I follow that up with 9/11 mythology, the big lie of our time. And then two others I posted today, another media critique that got into the Libya lie as well as the 9/11 lie. And I called it What Passes for Journalism and Opinion in America. And another article, which I began deciding I wanted to write one article. It turned out to be five, including the one today not yet posted. The other one I put up today is called Another Century of War, which to me was the most important thing, the aftermath of 9/11. And indeed, it did launch another century of war. And then I have a brand new article that will go out tomorrow. And I call it, I wrote it today, but it won't be posted today. It'll be posted tomorrow. So I called it Echoes of the Big 9/11 Lie. It's another media critique, and I can't get off of this without any question. The 9/11 mythology is the big lie of our time, and it's unleashed literally a war on humanity in its wake. The victims have been vilified, and the perpetrators are called defenders of freedom and justice and keeping us safe. Well, nobody in America, or in most, at least many other countries, are less secure and safe now than they've ever been, certainly in America. This is the most unsafe time ever for people in America. No one is safe, especially anybody who does what I do, taking on these people head on, no holds barred, no punches pulled. So 9/11 is important for me. One other comment, and I'll get to Marty. On the 9/11 day, I bought and saved a copy of the Wall Street Journal. I still have it. And I began my article today, pulling out that paper from a desk drawer, a spot that I had it in. And I quote, the entire front page was 9/11 related, and a good part of what was inside, including the editorials and op-eds and so on. Head out of business news, that's what the Wall Street Journal does. But it had a glaring headline. It's the kind of headline I remember the New York Times featured when World War II was declared. Something major, where they take the whole top spread of the paper in a glaring, full-cap letter headline. The Wall Street Journal never does it. New York Times never does it, unlike most city newspapers. But for an event like this, they did it. So I quoted it, and I quoted just the titles of the other articles that were written and the two editorials. And then there was an editorial in the Wall Street Journal that was put up yesterday, just an outrageous editorial. I tore it to shreds in my other media critique. I tore to shreds a disgraceful Washington Post editorial, a very long one. Wall Street Journal one was pretty long as well. I just ripped them up, and the way I like to do it is quote them and then have a spot that I say fact check. First I quote the lie, then I tell the truth. And I just went right down the line. I couldn't do it. I didn't want to cover everything they did. I took the most important parts and I did it. So you could read my articles, and if you don't know 9/11 truth, you'll certainly know a lot about it after reading my articles. And it's important, because the worst of what's happened happened as a result of that duplicitous lie. And literally, the Bush administration, the Obama administration, waging war on humanity. That's the only way to call it. It's going on at home as well as abroad. It's not just in the Middle East, North Africa, Central Asia. It's going on right on the streets of America. There's a war on Islam, right on the streets of America. Anyway, let me get to Mahdi. Mahdi spent 2 months or more in Libya, and a number of times he gave us live report. Not live, we taped them, because at times we had connecting live, so we taped them a couple of days in advance. But Mahdi gave reports on what was going on the ground in Libya. He was in the Tripoli area, but he got around, and he saw for his hand what was happening. So don't the duplicitous corporate media scoundrels. They're there. They were there with Mahdi. They saw the things that he saw. Did they report them? No. They lied. And they're still lying. So if you read anything in the New York Times, see it on CNN, on the BBC, on National Public Radio, public broadcasting, the whole lot of them, they lie. And you'll never know what really is going on. As far as I know, the war is still raging in Libya. And whenever the bombing ends, and it hasn't yet, years of conflict may continue after this. Who knows? Mahdi, I welcome you. I don't usually give a long introduction, but I had to today.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you very much. It's very good to be on your show again.
You were at you've been at a couple of conferences talking about Libya and maybe 9/11. Talk about what went on and your thoughts.
Well, I was in Montreal. I'm actually back in Montreal. I'm not in Ottawa right now. I will go to Ottawa later today, this evening. I also went to Toronto to speak about Libya. So what I talked about in Montreal was how the events of September 11th, the tragic events, that on that day were used for a military agenda against several states in Central Asia, the Middle East, and North Africa. But I specifically focused on Libya and the war crimes and atrocities being committed there by the Obama administration and by various NATO governments and their allies such as Qatar and the United Arab Emirates and Jordan. So this was the gip of my talks, and I was there with I spent a good few days with Professor Michel Chesedovsky, the director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and one of the most senior professors at the University of Ottawa in its social science faculty, and also former congresswoman and presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney, who should be back in the United States now. There were many other people there in Toronto, for example, U.S. Senator and Splitting the Sky. And if you don't know who Splitting the Sky is, this is a very courageous man, a man who attempted to arrest war criminals when none of our justice systems would do the same. So Splitting the Sky, he was one of the principal leaders of the Attica Rebellion, and he's a leader within the indigenous North American community, the United States and Canada. And it was a real honor to speak to him. And I learned a lot about the relations between Native Americans and Libya, actually speaking to him. And before I left Toronto yesterday, we had breakfast, and during breakfast he was telling Cynthia and myself about the treaty, the verbal treaty between the indigenous people of North America and Libya to protect one another's rights as human beings. So this is very important, and this is something I think people should know about. So it was a very the last few days have been very eventful, you know, going back and forth between three cities in Canada and between southern Ontario and Quebec, And I'm looking forward to going back and catching up. I have a lot of things to catch up on the next few days. And I'd also want to add that I met a lot of good people the last few days. And there was one specific couple that I met in Toronto who are big fans of yours.
Oh, really? Who?
The Taylors.
I'm sorry?
Their last name is Taylor. They're a wonderful couple and wonderful husband and wife, and they're big fans of yours, and they listen to your show all the time, so they're probably listening to this. And,
I say hello to them, and I thank them so much for their support. That literally is the energy that keeps me going.
Oh, yeah, you have fanfare in Toronto. You have fanfare here in Canada. So I wanted to let you know, and they told me how much that they listen. Ms. Taylor said she listens to your show all the time. Doesn't miss it.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I know there were two people in Toronto who I'm also rather friendly with, Peter Dale Scott and David Ray Griffin.
Yeah, they I didn't see Peter Dale Scott. Professor Scott, I didn't see him, but Mr. Griffin, David Ray Griffin was there, yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, they've both been on this program, Marty, and David has a brand-new book out. I have my copy, and I quoted from it in one of my 9/11 articles. His newest book is called 9/11, 10 Years Later, and David, unfortunately, months back, had a near-fatal illness. So I think he's pacing himself and doesn't want to do too much. He has a couple of very reliable people he works with, and they came on this program last fall to talk about his last book, Cognitive Infiltration, and they'll be back again in early October to talk about his newest book. And I had asked David to come on this program today, Marty, on September 11th, and he told me that he couldn't because he'd be in Toronto. I didn't know what was going on in Toronto, except that he'd be there. Otherwise, he probably would have been on today, but his other close associates will represent him on this program in October. And
okay.
Peter comes on. I never want to impose on Peter. He's even a few years older than I am. so I want to go easy on him. But he's a marvelous person, absolutely marvelous. And it's a joy to have him on this program, a very distinguished guy.
Well, the other thing is I went to the United Church, which is a Protestant church, and that's where I spoke about Libya. I specifically went to Toronto to speak about Libya. I did go to the hearings at Ryerson University, and I was present there. And the hearings from they were very very at points very academic, I guess, because you had an esteemed panel of professors, and it was international as well. So it was mostly run by scholars and professors, and I found that very refreshing because, you know, people who speak about their views about the events of September 11th, they try to demonize them as being some fringe group or non-respectable, but this was run by university professors and scholars, so this was very refreshing for me to be at Ryerson University and hear them speak, you know, and I want to point that out and emphasize that these are people, these are academics. They're not the so-called crazies that the media and others try to portray about people that are questioning the events of 9/11. We don't know what happened fully on those days. The government has not answered so many questions, and it's very important to question the events of 9/11.
Marty, we know plenty. We know enough to point fingers in the right direction.
Yes. But I'm pointing out that based on what the government says, the U.S. government, we don't really know what happened. Like, their explanations do not really fill in any of the blanks. Of course we know what happened. And more importantly,
even some members of the 9/11 Commission later got so disgusted they came out and made statements that stopped just short of saying everything that the commission reported was a bald-faced lie. The official story is a bald-faced lie. Max Cleland, a former U.S. senator, member of the 9/11 Commission, resigned, saying, and I quote, what they were doing, quote, is a national disgrace, unquote. In other words, that's the equivalent of saying the official story is a bald-faced lie.
I fully agree, and that is my position, too. They've lied about everything from what happened to the Pentagon to what happened in New York City and Pennsylvania.
They sure did.
But what I am trying to emphasize on is that we have a right, and people have a right to question what happened and call for a new investigation. And of course we know.
And
we know that it's been used.
And more than that, Marty, I think we have a right to ask for their heads, for the carnage that they have inflicted on humanity. And it really goes back to August of 1990, the Kuwait-Iraqi debacle, that Kuwait was literally suckered into going into Kuwait. Saddam wasn't as smart a guy as he thought he was, but he was suckered in by Washington to do what he did so Washington could get the Gulf War, and it was all downhill after that.
Yeah, they entrapped Iraq into going into Kuwait to launch a war, and before that they made Iran and Iraq two historic neighbors, two long-time allies. They've been, not allies, two countries that have been living together for hundreds of years. They made them go to war with each other.
Well, that was in the 1980s. They gave them a decade of war.
Yeah, they make people fight each other. This is what they're doing in Libya. They're making the Libyans fight each other, and they're bringing outsiders, you know. This is what they're doing in the whole Middle East. They're making different groups fight each other. This is what they did in the East.
Oh, absolutely, Marty. Marty, do you still have contacts with people in Libya?
Yes, before I even got on your show, I spoke to friends.
Tell listeners what you know about what's going on the ground, as best as you can make sense out of it all.
No, the government of Libya is still there. I want to emphasize that the government of Libya is still there.
When you say the government of Libya, you're talking about the legitimate government,
yes.
Not the U.S.-appointed puppet government, the so-called Transitional Council.
The U.S.-installed Transitional Council, the NATO-installed Transitional Council, is not the legitimate government of that country, okay? In my eyes, at least, and under international law. That government is not the legitimate government. Going off the point. The Libyan Arab Jumu'iyya, its government's still there. It's still there and they're still fighting, and I don't want people to think Tripoli is totally collapsed. They're still fighting around Tripoli. They still haven't taken over Fezzan. They still haven't taken over major cities in the West. They haven't taken over Sirte. So they're still fighting. So the media here and the Obama administration and the U.S. State Department and Hillary Clinton and the Canadian government of Stephen Harper and the British government and the French government and the Italian government all want you to think that the government there has collapsed. They want hope to be erased. But the government there has not collapsed. And they all envisage fighting, civil war style fighting and terrorism to last there for a few years. And that's what they want. They want a repeat of Afghanistan and Iraq in the Libyan Arab Jumu'iyya, and they want fighting to last for several years while they act like parasites and siphon all the wealth and natural resources of the country, and they prevent it from becoming a strong leader in Africa. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to fuel the fighting there. And they're going to fuel the violence, and they're going to fuel the crime, and they're responsible for all this. Nuremberg-style war crimes have been committed there, and I will never stop emphasizing that. And it's very important for the international community, the real international community, the people of the world, the people of Canada, the people of the United States, the people of Western Europe, the people of Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, the rest of the Arab world, China, Australia, the rest of Africa, South America. Everybody has to know that war crimes have been committed in Libya. Just like they've been committed in Afghanistan.
Big-time war crimes, Marty, big-time war crimes. I said that I think a conservative estimate of the number of deaths that have taken place over the past 6 months or so, Libyans, round number, 100,000, but they're dying every single day. The bombing goes on every single day. Libyans are dying, innocent people, mostly civilians, 100,000 in a country of 6 million. I extrapolated that, and for every person killed, figure maybe another 5 are injured. And then all of the surviving family members, so it multiplies out like ripples in an ocean or ripples in a pond. I extrapolated, Marty, to America that has 50 times the population of Libya. And I said, and I wrote, if this catastrophe happened to America, we'd be talking about 5 million dead Americans, maybe 25 million injured Americans, and all those other family members affected. We could be talking about a catastrophe directly affecting maybe 75 million Americans. That would be unprecedented in U.S. history. Absolutely unbelievable. Americans can't even conceive of something like that happening. In World War II, America lost something like 360,000 killed.
Wait,
something like that.
Can I point something out? 100 million natives were killed in North America.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, we shouldn't forget that either.
Oh, absolutely. Over a century, Marty. Over a century. Oh, more than a century.
Hello?
Marty, are you there?
Yeah, I'm there.
Oh, don't know what happened.
It's just briefly disconnected.
Oh, no, you're not disconnected. We're still on. I hope we're still on. Indeed. I have written about the greatest genocide in world history by far, as far as we know. Nearly the entire indigenous population of the Americas annihilated. There were small numbers left after more than a century, a couple of centuries, maybe a few centuries, from the time the Westerners showed up in what is the area called Haiti and the Dominican Republic now. And there they wiped out the native people to the last man, woman, and child. That's why there were black people in Haiti. There were no black people in Haiti when the Westerners came over, and they were replaced. The ones that were slaughtered were replaced by black African slaves.
Yeah, and even speaking about the present population in Haiti, see, we call them black or Africans brought there. We don't even know the exact origins of these people. Their identities have also been stolen. And, you know, a lot of African Americans, you know, I was speaking to Cynthia, and she said something very powerful to me while we were going to Toronto. She told me I have the luxury to know that I'm a quarter this or I'm that, and my history and my pedigree, but she doesn't have that. It's been stolen from her and many other people there. You know, she was very strong about this point. Since you brought up the people in Haiti, I want to mention that too. So there's a real strong feeling of inequality amongst many people in the African American community, and they don't have that luxury to know their exact identity, their exact whereabouts, from where in Africa their ancestors were taken as slaves. And this war in Libya has only managed to make those feelings stronger, because this war in Libya is an attack on all Africa. It shows this disregard for human life, and it shows that there still is a colonial and imperial project against the entire continent of Africa. Libya was the crown of Africa. It was a pan-African leader, and look what they do to it. You know, and look what they've done to the rest of Africa, from Congo to the Ivory Coast.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, of course, what's been done to Africa has been done in so many other places. This is the face of imperialism, Marty, and it's practiced more brutally by America than any other empire in the past. Of course, those other empires didn't have the kind of weapons that America has. They may have matched the ruthlessness of America, but America has the firepower to do what others maybe couldn't have even have conceived. But it's shocking that a country I live in, and I have shame about it, this country has the audacity to call itself a democracy. This country is a rogue criminal empire, literally raining terror on humanity everywhere it touches down. When America shows up, death and destruction follow. That's the real symbol of America. And they go after their best, too. They lock up innocent people. And I said at the top of the program, we've waged a war on Islam, on innocent Muslim people because of their faith, their ethnicity. This is what was done for political advantage. And I've used a tagline that for these people, it turned out for them that they were guilty of being Muslims in America at the wrong time. Well, it never was the right time, Marty, as long as I've been alive, but it couldn't have been a worse time since September 11th, 2001. And they became the innocent people to victimize and hold up as terrorists and bad guys and fifth column threats in our midst. And this is what people who run this country do. They earn their living doing things like this, Marty.
Can I make two points about that? The first is we have to really always be very particular in defining, separating the people running the United States at the political level and U.S. foreign policy. That's one thing from the American people. Because most of the American people, a lot of them might not know what's going on, are decent, and they do not want these imperial wars, and they do not want blood in the hands of the United States.
Let me just interject one comment, Marty. I certainly don't mean the American people. The American people are victims of
yes.
what their government is doing.
Yes.
I'm talking about the rogues sitting in high places in Washington, and they have a lot of allies in state and local governments. Chicago, Marty, has a war criminal as its mayor, Rahm Emanuel.
Yes, he is a war criminal, and these people are a minority, and they've hijacked the United States. The United States government is being used as an agent for these people. They're using it to impose their greedy wills on the rest of humanity. And it's not the United States alone. There's a lot of other governments that act like this. Governments act as agencies for a minority against their own population and the rest of the world. And in regards to Muslims, I want to point out that since these wars are being waged against Muslim countries and Muslim areas of geopolitical importance, this is why Muslims are being demonized. If these wars were being waged against areas that were maybe Eastern Orthodox Christians, or if they were Buddhists, you'd see them being demonized. Like, for example, in the former Yugoslavia, they demonized the Serbs. You know, they made the Muslims look like victims, essentially, and they demonized the Eastern Orthodox Serbs.
So, it was an anomaly. It just happened that there were Muslims they could use as victims.
Exactly. That's my main point. And I want to refer to Brzezinski, the former U.S. National Security Advisor under President Carter. He has said, he has pointed out, that we cannot, if we want to sustain empire in war, we cannot afford to have a multicultural society in the United States. Demonization is part of these wars. You know, if Americans were living, well, Americans see their fellow American Muslims and they see that they're not too different from them, they'll say, wait a minute, these aren't the monsters that drink blood that you're telling us about and have no hearts. They'll say, no, they're just like us. So they're demonizing the domestic Muslim population to legitimize or to legitimize their foreign wars in Muslim countries, essentially. That's why they demonize them. When they go to war with China, you'll see them do the same thing with the Chinese.
That's exactly right, Marty.
That's what they did to the Japanese. That's what they were doing to the Japanese during
Marty,
war.
We're just about out of time. I used a line in one article that America demonized the Japanese during World War II, and I've got a book that goes into the propaganda of the way they were described in the most vile and vicious way. Well, the Japanese today are Muslim people. They're Latino immigrants. They're always indigenous Americans, and these are today's Japanese. And we interred the Japanese during World War II, and we inter the undocumented Latinos today, and we persecute and we inter. Well, we inter them for a lot longer than the Japanese were during the Second World War. We inter innocent Muslims that we indict and we convict, even though they didn't do a thing. They just happened to live in this country at the wrong time.
Marty,
a final quick comment.
Hello?
Yes, a final quick comment, Marty.
Okay, well, I was going to say that Muslim Americans are your modern-day Japanese. If they go to war with Russia and China one day, you're going to see them doing the same thing. In fact, the process has already started with the media demonization, but you'll see them treating Russian Russian citizens and Chinese citizens in a very similar way. In fact,
there's no question about it. Marty, I'm going to wrap it up, and you are a dear friend, and I look forward to getting you back many, many times more to talk about all these vital things, including when you write one of your magnificent articles. We can discuss that. And I didn't even introduce you properly. My God, let me just, I'll end by introducing you properly. Marty is a Middle East Central Asian expert, and he's a research associate for the Center of Research on Globalization. Marty, my great thanks to you.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you.
Bruce, I know we're connected. At least I think we're connected. And let me introduce you properly. Bruce Gagnon. Bruce is the co-founder and the coordinator of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space. And he has also provided, he's doing lots of things all the time. Among them, he provided extensive coverage of America's plan for a greater Asian footprint. My God, they don't have a big enough footprint now across the globe with well over 1,000 bases. Oh, it's well over 1,000. It could be 2,000 with the hundreds of bases in Afghanistan. But they want another one on this idyllic South Korean island called Jeju. That is a heritage site, and the U.S. Navy, the Pentagon, they want to rip it up and put a U.S. base there. Well, the South Korean people are not too happy about that, and they're fighting back. Bruce, I want to let you get into the things that you're most focused on now, including your thoughts on 9/11. Welcome, Bruce.
Hi, Steve. Good to be with you again.
Oh, it's terrific having you on. We tried to connect a couple of times, and I conflicted with a conference or two or three that you were at.
Yeah, it's a busy time, but I'm happy to be here.
Oh, I'm delighted we made it, and we certainly made it on a very interesting day, to say the least.
That's for sure. As I think of 9/11, I think of the pretext for war. That's the bottom line of what 9/11 turned out to be. And we've been at war ever since, and it's justified both a war around the world, an escalation of that, and also a war at home on the American people through loss of our civil liberties, cutbacks in human needs and social progress. So it's a global war, and of terror. I wouldn't say it's a war on terror, but it's a global war of terror, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, there's no question. I use the term state terror, as opposed to, I wrote an article once, Bruce, Terrorism Defined, I think the title was, and I talked about the different kinds of terrorism, and there's only one kind that really concerns me, the kind that really hits hard, and that's state terrorism. And there's no question that the people who run America are state terrorists, and they literally terrorize people across the globe. And, you know, wherever they want to put an extra footprint, wherever they think the ruling regime of a nation isn't 100% cooperative, 99% isn't good enough, it's got to be 100% on the big stuff. The little things the leaders get wiggle room on, but on the big stuff it's got to be 100%. And if it isn't that way, then they'll pressure them, they'll threaten them, there could be a coup, and the last resort may be war, but America certainly has a history of fighting one war after another. And
during the Bush administration, the Pentagon was saying that under corporate globalization of the world economy, that every country was going to have a different role, a different job, you know, and that we're not going to have industrial jobs in America anymore, they said, because obviously it's cheaper for corporations to maximize their profits by going overseas. So they said our role, America's role, under corporate globalization would be security export. And so it's no coincidence today that the number one industrial export product of America is weapons. And the Pentagon went on to say that there's a part of the world today that is not submitting to the authority of corporate globalization, that they're not yet brought into line. And they went on to say that this will be our role under security export. America's role in the world economy will be to fight endless wars to bring this, what they called non-integrating gap, under control. And in this particular case, it was Thomas Barnett, the a futurist and instructor at the Naval War College at that time in Rhode Island, who was making this speech to a room full of high-level military brass. He was introduced as Donald Rumsfeld's strategy guy. And he went on to say that, to describe this non-integrating gap, he said it's the Middle East, where we are in Iraq today, Central Asia, where we are in Afghanistan today. He said Africa will be fighting 20 years from now for their oil. Well, we recently invaded Libya, that just so happens to have the largest oil deposits in all of Africa. And then parts of Latin America, for example, Venezuela, where Hugo Chavez is not towing the line of corporate globalization, the international banking community, the U.S. and British oil major corporations. And so these are the parts of the world that the Pentagon is saying that we will be fighting endlessly to bring under control for corporate globalization. Basically, it's about resource wars, extracting resource, declining resources in this coming period of time. And the American people will be bled. We'll have our Social Security, our Medicare, our Medicaid cut, with Republicans and Democrats joining together, cutting back on education, health care, etc., building up the military endlessly for these wars to benefit corporate globalization. Well, that's the plan, and it's well underway in terms of implementation. Now it's up to the American people to react and to stop this plan from any further implementation, because they're literally turning us into slaves here in this country, both in terms of our rights, our civil rights, our freedoms of speech and assembly and privacy, but also beginning to turn us into basically a feudal society, a corporate feudal society.
That is the plan, Bruce. There is no question about it. And it takes place cleverly. These people aren't stupid. They literally can pull this stuff off in plain sight. And Americans, most Americans, have no idea what was going on. Can I give you a case in point? Obama gave a speech to a joint session of Congress on Thursday night, and I ripped it apart in an article the next day. One of the things in his speech, he talked about tax cuts. Well, most of the tax cuts go to corporate favorites and super rich people who already have too much. But he talked about tax cuts for everybody. What tax cuts did he refer to? He referred to payroll tax cuts. Last year, there was a one-year period where payroll taxes for individual wage earners, ordinary people listening to this program in America, the rate was cut from 6.2% to 3.1%, cut it in half. Corporations didn't get any cut. This year, he's proposing, in his speech, he proposed cut the 3.1%, I think it was to 2.1%, but also cut the corporate payroll tax. Corporations, employers, match the individual's tax. They each
You're
pay
talking about Social Security now, right?
Well, this is to cover Social Security and Medicare.
Yeah.
Employers wage earners, a wage earner meaning anybody who gets a paycheck, pay 6.2%, until for individuals it was cut to 3.1% last year. Obama wants to cut for corporations to 3.1%, but for all new hires they make, no payroll tax. What does this mean? Is this really a legitimate tax cut for people? Absolutely not. It's exactly the opposite of a legitimate tax cut. Why? Because the plan, and this is in my new book, I have a chapter on the chopping block to get rid of Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, which is welfare. Social Security and Medicare are not entitlements, they're insurance programs. We pay all workers pay premiums on their insurance. An insurance policy is a contract. It's supposed to pay off at a designated time. Life insurance, when you die, your beneficiaries get it. Social Security and Medicare, when you retire at age 65 or whatever, you're supposed to get it. Well, you don't. I don't get the full benefit now. I pay plenty for my Medicare. I shouldn't have to pay 10 cents, but the contract was violated. They want to eliminate it altogether with a way station in between, Bruce. It's called privatization. And after Wall Street rapes it dry, then they want to take the empty shell, just like the subprime mortgages and the toxic derivatives and the rest of the junk that they were left with. They just want to throw it in the trash and end it altogether. But the plan is a two-step process. By cutting the payroll tax, they are depriving the so-called trust fund of revenue to fund Medicare and Social Security for retirees and disabled people who qualify. Well, what they will say, Bruce, is as they drain the trust fund dry, the funds will be gone. They'll be able to say these funds are closer to insolvency. Aha, we really have a crisis, and it's getting here faster than we thought, so we have to cut, 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 change, change, change. That's what Obama's plan is all about. If he wants to give ordinary working people a tax break, cut the lowest rate, give them a tax credit, give the wealthiest people nothing. Nothing. What should he do with them? Raise their rates. Their rates are too low. Get rid of the capital gains tax. Raise the rate on top wage earners, people making $500,000 or more, $1 million or more a year. Make them pay. Give the benefit to ordinary working people who need it. That is exactly what won't be done. It's another ripoff. This was in his plan. The whole plan that he proposed on Thursday night was a ripoff on working Americans to benefit corporate America and the super rich even more, and I ripped his address to shreds.
Well, you know, Obama's job is to continue the Bush policies, both foreign and domestic, but to do one very important thing that Bush couldn't do, and that was to demobilize the opposition on the left. And he's done that very effectively. He's divided the so-called liberals from the people further on the left who are more critical of his policies. He's very effectively done that. I heard you earlier refer to your current mayor as one of these corporate stooges, and in fact, one of his primary jobs when he worked in Obama's White House was to send out daily talking points to so-called liberal organizations, national groups based in Washington. And if any of them didn't toe the line, he, your new mayor, would call their funders and have them defunded. And so there was, at the very outset of the Obama administration, a very strategic effort made to shut down and make very timid progressive organizations, whether they were environmental, labor, social justice, whatever, to make them afraid to stand against any of these Obama policies. And so clearly the oligarchy, those rich people that control this government, those corporate people, are very happy with Obama. And I believe they'll keep him in place. Why wouldn't they? Because he's done a fantastic job of, again, demobilizing the opposition to imagine if Bush was a president right now. Here we are 10 years later against war. He would now be trying to cut and eviscerate Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. Why, my God, the liberal community, the many Democrats would be on the street hollering and screaming. But you hear very little from that same constituency when their president or someone who they consider their president is in power doing this.
Well, that's exactly right, Bruce. And Bush's approval rating, it bumped around a lot, but it got down to some of the lowest approval ratings any U.S. president ever had, down around the 20% level. That's pretty dismal. Obama is bumping along around the 40% level, and it shocks me and it disappoints me that so many people are still fooled by this guy who is a combination war criminal, serial liar, anti-populist. he absolutely thumbs his nose at his own people, his core constituency. He basically told them to go to hell. He doesn't care about them. He's not only not doing anything for them, he is harming them grievously. Well, he's lost them.
Please name me one thing Obama has done for the black community in America.
Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. Absolutely zero. He's done nothing. He's an absolute disgrace. And of course, I mean, he's done nothing for ordinary working people in America overall. But the black community in America, they were thrilled to death that finally they had one of their own in the White House. Little did they know, a black face means nothing. It's what the person there will do. How will that person govern? Doesn't matter, black, white, Muslim, Christian, Jew, man, woman, young, old, makes no difference. Mickey Mouse could sit in that White House if Mickey Mouse could govern responsibly. And if that were the case, I'd say vote for Mickey Mouse.
Well, you know, the oligarchy is looking at demographic changes in America, and they see that in the next short few years, blacks and Hispanics are going to be the majority population in America. And so they very astutely said, we've got to begin to come up with our own people of color that we control, that we can make, you know, president of the United States, for example. And so they identified Obama early on. In fact, Zbigniew Brzezinski, Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, the guy that helped arm the Taliban in Afghanistan to push out the former Soviet Union out of Afghanistan. Brzezinski identified Obama way back when he was a student at Columbia University. And then when he was a state senator from your state, and it was decided that the oligarchy decided they needed to develop a person of color to run for office. One of the people that was the early on funders for his campaign, someone that you might be familiar with from Chicago, the Crown family, which at that time were majority stockholders in the General Dynamics Corporation. Well, the General Dynamics Corporation has a facility right here in my community where I live in Bath, Maine, where they're building Aegis destroyers that are being outfitted with missile defense systems. Well, as soon as Obama came into office, he said, I'm getting rid of Bush's missile defense program. I'm shutting it down. And instead, I'm going to put emphasis on the use of Aegis destroyers with their missile defense systems. We're going to increase production of them. We're going to increase deployment of them. And he has done so, beginning an encirclement of Russia and China using these systems, which he now wants to additionally put on ground-based launchers. Early on, you mentioned about a base in Jeju Island, South Korea, that the U.S. is basically forcing the South Korean government to build. It will be a port, a naval base, to port these very Aegis destroyers, because there's so many of them being built now to the benefit of General Dynamics, thanks to Mr. Obama, who's essentially paying back his major campaign contributor. And but at the same time, it's increasing tensions and is going to cause a new arms race with both Russia and China. So this is absolutely, as far as I'm concerned, clear evidence that Obama was from the outset a tool of the military-industrial complex, of the corporations. As it turns out, we now know, I read it myself in aerospace industry publications right after the election, that Obama was given more campaign donations by the military-industrial complex than John McCain got, who was a war hawk, we all know, in the last election.
That's amazing. I didn't know that. Well, Bruce, are you still on?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, I heard a click. I get nervous when I hear a click. Well, that might be my CIA or FBI friends taking a bathroom break or something or other. I know they never miss any one of my programs.
Oh, I bet.
Of course, they can listen to them archived if they have another engagement. There's no problem. Everything archived after the program. But, this is all hideous stuff. And I wrote about the Aegis plan to build all of these super powerful attack ships. and they also want to deploy them near Russia's borders. Russia is apoplectic over some of these plans. They want to stick these ships in the Mediterranean, maybe in the Black Sea. I mean, they literally want to put them in firing range of Russia, and Russia is not at all very pleased about this. But, of course, Russia and China have basically been encircled with U.S. bases. Bruce, can you imagine if either of those countries or any other country stuck one single base in Canada, in Mexico, and I mean, we all know what happened when there were missiles or whatever came into Cuba back in the early 1960s. We came close to a nuclear war.
That's right.
I mean, that was under Jack Kennedy.
We'd be going bananas, but you're exactly right. At this moment, the U.S., with its military tool, NATO, is absolutely encircling Russia. Now, when I tell some people that, of course, their first question is, why would we do that? Why would we restart the Cold War? And I remind them that Russia has the world's largest supply of natural gas, and they also have significant supplies of oil. And so we know now that wherever there are resources, particularly fossil fuel resources around the world, the U.S. has made the military strategy to control them. And if it means war, so be it. Now, why would the United States at the same time be encircling China as we are today by building more bases, increasing the size of our bases in Japan, South Korea, now deploying weapon systems in Taiwan, so-called missile defense interceptors that are part of that are the shield of the first strike sword and shield. And so why would the U.S. be doing that to China? It's crazy, right? Well, as it turns out, the Pentagon has made the determination that we're not going to be able to economically compete with China. But if we control the keys to China's economic engine, meaning their access to oil, then we will control them. And so, as it turns out, China imports 80% of its oil on ships along the Yellow Sea route into China, into mainland China. And so the U.S. is now doubling its military presence in this particular part of the world, so that we have the ability to choke off their ability to import their oil, so that we will control their access to oil. This Navy base on Jeju Island, South Korea, for example, sits at the very entrance, the heart, if you will, the opening of the Yellow Sea. So it's a prime strategic location that the U.S. wants to be, and they want to be there.
Can you imagine if something ever went awry in a war between China and Russia erupted? What worries me, Bruce, is that we don't know. It could be the next step after the Libya carnage would be to go after Syria. Possibly Iran would get involved, or an attack on Iran might happen. If either of those happen, the entire Middle East could go up, and China and Russia both have interests in those countries, especially Iran. But Russia has its only Mediterranean base in a Syrian port, Tartus, and that's why Russia absolutely wants nothing to do with the UN resolution targeting Syria.
The U.S. Space Command for the past several years annually has been wargaming a U.S. first strike attack on China set in the year 2016. And in that attack, the United States uses as its first weapon the military space plane that is now under development, the successor to the shuttle. This shuttle program has been closed down, as we all know. And this military space plane would fly down from orbit, from space, drop a devastating attack on China. Now, China today has 20 nuclear missiles capable of hitting the west coast of the United States. And so the Space Command is wargaming a first strike attack on those 20 nuclear missiles. A few of them escape being taken out in that first strike, and China then fires a retaliatory attack on the United States after they've been hit. And that's when the U.S. so-called missile defense systems come into play. In fact, they are, again, the shield to be used after the U.S. has fired its first strike weapon. And so this is the kind of military apparatus that is being developed today and being deployed under the Obama administration in a very, very vigorous way. And so while Obama, remember, he went to Prague and he talked about nuclear disarmament and, oh, we want to get rid of nuclear weapons. Well, it was all talk. It was show. It was a game. That's why I call him the magician. You have to watch both of his hands, because as he was saying that at the very same time, he was escalating the funding, escalating the technology development, and escalating the deployment of these so-called missile defense systems, what we really actually call missile offense systems. So this is where Obama and the Pentagon are. They're about encircling and recreating the Cold War, both with Russia and China, the most provocative, dangerous, and expensive strategy that you can ever imagine. And that's why Obama has to defund social progress, because in order to pay for all this insanity, he's got to take the money out of social progress.
That's exactly right. The honeypot of Social Security and Medicare and the other social programs, we're talking about trillions and trillions of dollars. Every wage earner pays into them monthly. Imagine getting their grubby paws on this money so they can plan what could turn out to be a nuclear war, Bruce. I mean, can you imagine the calamity of a nuclear war? And I don't care what kind of a missile defense offense system you have. Nuclear weapons would explode. High megatonnage nuclear weapons would explode on U.S. cities. Can you imagine Los Angeles being taken out, San Francisco being taken out, Chicago or New York or Washington taken out? China can Russia for certain, can strike anywhere in the globe, and whether China can do it now or not, by 2016 you can bet they'll be able to do it, and they may not have our stockpile, but they'll have plenty of nuclear weapons of high megatonnage, and one of them each could easily knock out a city like Chicago, Los Angeles, or New York. And if they're struck, they absolutely will strike back, as will Russia.
Yeah, it's absolute insanity, the whole thing. And we've got to respond by organizing to oppose all of this. And I've long been saying to people that if you want to stop Star Wars, if you want to stop the development of this new arms race in space that Obama is helping to foster, the best way to do it is to fight for social progress, fight for Social Security, fight for Medicare, for Medicaid, fight for public education, fight for funding of infrastructure repair, and fight to tax the rich and the corporations. And I'd like to urge people to check our website, where we have all of this information that I've been talking about. The web address is spaceforpeace.org, spaceforpeace.org.
Oh, that is a simple title to remember, Bruce. spaceforpeace.org, and Bruce spells his last name G-A-G-N-O-N. You could Google Bruce's name and you can find out plenty, his websites and so on. Bruce, we're out of time. This was a marvelous discussion. I look forward to getting you back again. I echo what you're saying. There's only one way to stop these people. It's up to us at the grassroots. And if we don't stop them, they're going to steal everything from us, including our lives. And if there's ever a nuclear war, just think nuclear winter. What does nuclear winter mean? It means the end of human life on the planet. You think that's impossible? It's not impossible. You fire off nuclear weapons, and nuclear winter is a reality. Is that worth fighting to stop? You betcha. Bruce,
thank you, Stephen.
I thank you so much. And again,
okay,
join us next week, Thursdays, 11 a.m., weekends, 1 p.m. We got to keep at this. It's our only chance.